you can explore an exclusive collection of case law at Decisus Law Reports. Browse a comprehensive collection of nearly 14,000 reports of Irish legal judgments delivered since 2011. Visit decisus.ie to find out more.
Hello, and you're very welcome to episode 64 of The Fifth Court, a podcast on legal affairs presented by myself, Peter Leonard, Barrister.
Myself, Mark Tottenham, Barrister and editor of Decisus Law Reports.
Mark, good to see you as always. And last week, you will recall, we had a wonderful discussion about the proposed changes to the Constitution in the referendum, which is a referenda, which is due to be held.
I think the plural is referendums.
Referendums, is it? Is it not referenda? Oh, well, okay, there you go. You learn something new every day. We had Dr. Deirdre McGowan from TU Dublin, and we had Dr. Maeve Harding from UCD. They've written an amazing family law book, folks. It's really, really good. And they were brilliant discussing this issue.
And I think there's still a few days to go before the referendum, but on the day of release of this podcast. So anybody who still hasn't made their mind up,
so please go out and exercise your franchise,
and more
folks.
Importantly, go back and listen to the last episode.
Yes, great. And Mark, you also wanted to mention the Wild Atlantic Law School, which is coming
soon. Yeah. So Wild Atlantic Law is a festival of legal ideas that is going to happen in Ennistymon on the 1st and 2nd of May. And among the many interesting events that will be happening there is we will be doing a live interview for the Fifth Court.
Looking forward to that. And I see you've been very busy as well. Are you doing a bit of an article for the Village magazine? What's all that about?
I wrote an opinion piece about slaps.
Slaps? Okay.
Particularly in light of the Gerry Kelly case against Malachy O'Doherty.
Okay, wow. So that's one to watch, folks. So definitely. Village magazine, tune in. Okay, well, tonight we are going to boldly go where we have never gone before on this show. And we are going to discuss the law of space. The law of outer space.
Indeed.
Outer space. And, you know, who is entitled to be up there above the clouds, all that way up in the atmosphere, Mark? And we're going to discuss this topic with our colleague, Barrister Zeldine O'Brien. And, Mark, this is going to be a fascinating discussion.
Absolutely. And I think the question we all want to know is, where do we get to sue for incidents happening outside the Earth's atmosphere? And I think Zeldine will be able to help us in that.
This is great. This is really great. So stay tuned, folks. But first, we're going to look at three cases that you have identified from the Decisus website. And we start with a case about pleadings. Ryanair brought a case against an online travel agent for screen scrapping. Screen scrapping? Screen scraping. What does that mean?
Okay, so, well, there are loads of these cases, but basically Ryanair like people to book their flights on Ryanair's own website so that they can sell on all the stuff like sort of car hire and hotels and that kind of thing. But there's lots of online travel agents that try to sell Ryanair tickets on their websites.
Okay, and so that's Ryanair, called scraping, is it?
They call
it,
yeah.
To scrape.
And Ryanair generally say that it is in breach of the conditions of their website.
Okay. Well, look, let me just go back to the intro here. And it says, in its defense, the travel agent tried to raise issues of competition law as an appendix, but without directly pleading them. So this was Mr. Justice Nolan. And what did he find? This is the case of Ryanair Limited versus On the Beach Limited. Wow.
On the Beach, indeed. Yeah. So what happened here, this is a case of some antiquity in Ireland. So Ryanair have sued On the Beach in Ireland. There's also similar...
Is that not a cocktail?
I think that's a different one. Ryanair on the beach. Yeah. So there are similar proceedings involving the same parties in the UK, where On the Beach have counterclaimed for breaches of competition law, and essentially saying that Ryanair, by trying to restrict use of their website, are abusing a dominant position in the market. Now, in their defence in the Irish proceedings, they tried to raise this issue, but instead of pleading it as a defence or as a counterclaim, they simply stuck it into their defence as an appendix. And so the question was, well, what is the purpose of this? And Ryanair brought an application to strike out this portion of the defence. And what Mr. Justice Nolan said was, you know, he's seen appendices to pleadings before which are there for information or convenience. But when you're actually trying to plead something of substance, you're either pleading it or you're not pleading it. In this case,
so don't put it into your appendix.
Exactly.
Okay,
yeah,
fair enough.
So struck out.
Okay, great, Mark. Thank you for explaining that. And you learn something new every day. I now know what screen scraping is. In the second case, a lay litigant brought proceedings arising from certain medical treatment, including a claim that she had suffered adverse consequences from the use of a drug called Razalez Alicarian. Mark, you're going to have to help me with that one as well. The claim was dismissed by the High Court, but then appealed to the Court of Appeal. So this is the case of MN versus the Health Service Executive, the HSE, and it's a decision of Mr. Justice Robert Houghton.
Yeah, and this is this is a claim, I think, brought by a litigant in person, where she was claiming a lot of, she sued a number of different parties under a number of different headings, and there were various different issues that led to the claim being dismissed. But she appealed it to the Court of Appeal, and among the many issues that were determined here was that she was claiming that she'd had adverse effects from this particular drug. And because she hadn't brought expert medical opinion, that is basically, you can't bring a claim for any kind of medical negligence without getting an independent expert to say that you've got a claim.
Yes, absolutely.
And so
it has to be substantiated by an independent expert, of course. Okay, finally, in our final case, the High Court had to consider access and custody arrangements in judicial separation proceedings. The issue of nesting was discussed. What does this mean, Mark? You're going to have to explain what nesting is. And this is the case of M versus N, and it's a decision of Ms. Justice Nuala Jackson.
Yeah, as with all family law proceedings, or with a lot of them, there are a lot of different issues that arise. But I think the issue that commonly arises where a mother and father are effectively expected to provide two homes for their children if there's a kind of joint custody arrangement is problematic. And in this particular case, Ms. Justice Jackson made an order for what they described as nesting, which means essentially that the children remain in the home and the parents alternate there, that for some of the week or for some time the mother lives with them and for another time the father lives with them. Now,
so the only permanent residents are the kids.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And the term seems to be nesting. Now, she also said that that one of the parents would have exclusive residence in the home, so I'm not quite sure how that stacks in with the alternate arrangement.
That's an interesting
one, certainly
yeah.
that was the proposal that was approved in this case.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But you can sort of see the logic to that, really. I mean, children need a kind of a secure home.
Exactly.
And the adults, you know, they might be better able at moving about. Okay, so we're back shortly with our colleague, Barrister Zeldine O'Brien.
Silence in the Fifth Court.
Our guest in this episode of the Fifth Court is Zeldine O'Brien, a colleague of ours at the Bar of Ireland, who is also a part-time member of the International Protection Appeals Tribunal. But what interested us is that she says on her law library page that she is a specialist in the law of outer space, and that is what we are going to discuss today. So Zeldine, can you tell us what was it that first interested you in outer space law?
It was actually in my childhood I was very interested in sci-fi.
Sure.
So I remember watching reruns of Star Trek, the original series, as a girl on the rare days I was out sick from school. And I developed an interest in law later on. And then a very good friend of mine, Dermot Sheehan, who's also a colleague of ours at the bar now, we were in law school together and he brought the existence of space law to my attention. And it grew from there. I ended up applying in 2004 when I was a student at Trinity College for the European Space Agency's Student Participation Programme. And presented a paper that year at the International Institute of Space Law's annual colloquium on the law of outer space, which happened to be on space tourism.
Your paper was on space tourism?
Yes, that ended up grounding my undergraduate thesis in Trinity. Right. And then from there, I moved on to doctoral research in the area because I felt I wasn't done with it. that was how it began.
And can you tell us again, I'd say a lot of our listeners wouldn't be aware that there was such a thing as space law. Did space law have to start as soon as humans entered outer space, or was there any need for space law before then?
Well, I have to say the idea of space law, of the need for regulation to outer space, that was actually much earlier than actual human activity. So that began in the 1930s, where a lawyer called Vladimir Mandel, and he's considered by some to be the father of space law, he wrote and published in the early 1930s in the area, certainly in 1932.
What country is he from?
Originally Czechoslovakia.
Okay.
In 1952, he you had the first symposium in the idea on space law chaired by Lyndon B. Johnson. Well, and then, of course, you had Sputnik in 1957. Now, none of that is marking actual law. So the beginnings of when the UN gets involved is with the first resolution, and they passed that in 1958. So 1 year after Sputnik, and then there follows a number of resolutions from the United Nations, which are non-binding. But the most significant one I would have said would have been Resolution 1962, which was passed in 1963. And that was the Declaration of Legal Principles governing the activities of space states in the exploration and use of outer space. And that those principles went on to form the basis of the principles set out in the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, which marks the first hard law in the area.
So you're basically 1963 is the resolution. And remind me when the first manned, I was going to say staffed, whatever, space, it must have been around that time.
Alan Shepard, was it? John Glenn?
No, the Russian...
Yuri Gagarin.
Yeah, he was 59. It was
after 57. Okay. So it was sometime after that. In terms of your question of was there a need to have it, I would have said no, but was it envisaged as being something that would be needed? Yeah. Certainly yes, before it actually happened by some decades.
And from the time of President Kennedy to the first man on the moon, there was definitely an impetus from the US to put more people in space,
and,
wasn't there?
And also from the USSR. So
right. I mean, it's part of
they were the big space powers at that time. And the Outer Space Treaty, which remains in place today in Ireland, is a signatory, has ratified that. You also have the Rescue Agreement from 1968. So that followed on very quickly. The Liability Convention of 1972.
And the Rescue Agreement concerns what? Recovering people from space?
Yes, the rescue and return of not just astronauts, but their vehicles. Okay. So there are particular obligations.
And Zeldin, can I just ask you a practical question? Obviously, I mean, you know, above the clouds and all of that, we have all flown in planes, and that's obviously very strongly regulated. And so that is the law of the land, is it? Even though you're way up in
I would consider that in terms of international aviation, that's governed by the Chicago Convention 1944, which builds on the Paris Convention of 1919. So that's territorial space.
Okay.
So that's one of the key distinctions between the law of outer space and the law of air law. So air law governs territorial spaces. And outer space law is closer in analogical terms to the law of the high seas, in that it's an area in a physical sense that isn't appropriated by states.
Because we regularly hear the phrase, you know, entering Irish airspace, or, you know, in other countries where it's a little bit more serious when you enter their airspace. But where does space end, airspace end, and outer space begin?
Well, that is a really vexed question, and it has vexed the UN for quite some time, and it continues to be on the agenda and debated.
Hence the need for space lawyers.
There are two different approaches that you can see that emerge. The first is the idea of a functionalist approach. So if it's intended to go into outer space and it's going to be up in outer space, it's going to be governed by outer space law. And if it's intended to be in airspace, then it's clearly air law. Then you have the spatialist approach, which is what you see between the law of the high seas, the boundary between our territorial waters and high seas. There's a black line, which is your 12 nautical miles. And we've also seen from the law of the sea that can be changed over time. So it was 3 nautical miles, which was the cannon shot rule. So it was the area in traditional international law that you could say you could control.
Yes.
By way of the technology of the time.
So 3 nautical miles.
And then it extended out to 12. And then, of course, you've got the economic zone, but I'm going to park that for the moment. Whereas that spatialist approach, you don't see that in international space law and you don't see it in air law. Clearly, air law means you have a boundary, but in law, there isn't a set boundary in international law.
Presumably, there's an issue when it comes to satellites. There must be a stage at which a satellite will orbit Earth and not fall to the ground.
If it's in orbit, I think from the general approach you'd see in terms of the phrasing used in international, if it's in orbit, it's in outer space. And so getting up there, there's a right of free access that you see in the Outer Space Treaty. So getting up there is part of the right of access. The full limits of that have yet to be tested. But certainly the custom shows, and we do have now custom from 1957 to today's date, shows that people don't object to the idea at this time of putting a satellite and having it in orbit. Yeah.
If you go back in history and if you look at the likes of Captain Cook, you know, who sailed off around the world and arrives in Australia, for example, and declared it a terra nullius, you know, an empty piece of land that he was able to plant the Union Jack and say, I declare this for Britain. I mean, what's the story in terms of space? Because that is the great frontier now, isn't it? You know, where people go out. So if somebody lands on Mars, can they suddenly say,
no,
I'm going to claim this 75 acres for, I think, you know, my beloved country?
The short answer is no. And that's because no state can appropriate the moon, outer space or other celestial bodies. And that flows from Article 2 of the Outer Space Treaty. So that specifically says...
And who has signed that? Can I just ask you, who's committed to it?
The vast majority of countries. Of countries have signed that. And countries are... there is an argument to be made also, and has been made at the academic level, that that principle is part of custom at this stage as well. So that's one of the academic points that's made, in which case, even if you hadn't ratified the Outer Space Treaty, you'd still be bound by it. The major space powers have ratified that.
Anybody who's gone into space presumably has at this stage, is that fair to say?
So Article 2 of that just says it isn't subject to national appropriation by claim of sovereignty by means of use. Or occupation, or by any other means. So planting your flag on it won't work. And it's considered the idea of outer space, the moon and other celestial bodies are part of the common heritage of mankind. So they're not covered by the res nullis principle, they're res communis.
Is most of the law treaties is between countries, or are we reaching a stage where, you know, the likes of Elon Musk or Richard Branson, we've heard of wanting to bring private companies up into space? Is there now any private law when it comes to the law of outer space?
So it kind of depends on the approach you take to space law. If you're taking a very narrow definition of the corpus iuris spatialis, you're really thinking about those five international treaties. I mentioned the three of them. There's also the Registration Convention and the Moon Agreement from 1979, which is very poorly ratified, I must say. But those are the kind of the narrow understanding of it. If you're taking a broader understanding of international law that applies to outer space, you do have traditional international law in the sense of bilateral and multilateral agreements. So you have the Intergovernmental Agreement from 1998, which would be one of the most well-known ones, which is the agreement that governs the International Space Station. Classic multilateral state agreement, but you also have international instruments that create international intergovernmental bodies. So by way of example, the European Space Agency's Convention from 1979, to which Ireland is also a party, these two form part of international space law in the general sense. So does it involve states primarily? Yes. What happens to commercial undertakings? People sending up rockets? And the answer is, well, the Outer Space Treaty places an obligation on states and state parties to supervise their nationals' activities in outer space. So if you fail to supervise your nationals and you're letting them do whatever they want, that is arguendo a breach of that obligation, and that would be an internationally wrongful act. Okay. Therefore, by virtue of that, regulation of private entities falls to the state of their nationality.
Okay, well, you can imagine with all the activity, as Mark says, Elon Musk and all these people sending up satellites, and there's a lot of activity. When Sputnik went up in 57, it had the whole place to itself. And then obviously the Americans tried to follow up with kind of, you know, but now we have many different nations who are launching satellites. So, I mean, you can understand how there is the potential for a row. But we know from us based down here on terra firma, that, you know, when disputes arise, that's when the law kicks in. And I'm just wondering in terms, and then disputes lead ultimately to case law. Is there any case law, Zeldine? Have there been any rows? And my follow-on question, and I'm asking too many questions here, you should never ask multi-questions, but I am in this case. Do we have a court of law we can go to? Is there a space court?
Okay, so I will take those one
yes,
by one.
Do.
Notable disputes. I mean, there's a number of historical issues. I mean, the first one, I'd have to mention the Bagotao Declaration of 1976.
Okay, tell us about that, because I don't know anything about
so
that.
So there were eight equatorial countries who sought to claim, because there was no black line border, they sought to claim that their airspace went all the way up to geostationary orbit. And so that was Ecuador, Colombia, Brazil, Congo, Zaire, Uganda, Kenya and Indonesia. So there's a great discussion already by Thomas and Gangal on who owns the geostationary orbit in the Annals of Air and Space Law. It wasn't accepted. And it doesn't have...
Will you just explain that to me for a second? I'm sorry, I'm a slow learner here, but the geostationary orbit.
So
what's that mean?
It's a particular orbit. Now, there are obviously eccentricities in all orbits, but basically it means when you put it up there, it stays relatively over the part of the Earth.
Okay.
The place on the surface of the Earth as the Earth turns.
Okay.
So it's not stationary in a sense that the Earth is turning, it's turning in
so,
the universe.
So it broadly stays above the equator. Mm. Is that what you're saying? So that all of these equatorial countries were claiming, well, if they're over our land, therefore we should own them. Is that it?
Yes. Hmm. Well, not that they own them, but that they own the place that they occupied.
So they should be able to charge some kind of rent.
Yeah, they have. I think some of those countries...
It's kind of fair enough, isn't it?
Well, I don't think so, because the geostationary orbit is accepted as an orbit.
Okay.
And therefore, that is something that falls into outer space. If you're in orbit, clearly you have broken free of the potential for air-breathing propulsion. So they were trying to exploit the weakness in the definitional approach that had been taken, which was a functional approach, and I would say at an international level. But basically, it's fairly, I think, as Thomas Gangel points out, it's unambiguous. If you have an object in orbit around the Earth, that's in outer space. And that applies, there's no special orbit. An orbit is an orbit from a legal point of view. So what is more concerning is that was clearly in breach of what the Outer Space Treaty was saying. Other notable disputes, has there been any claims? You had one claim from Canada against the USSR. This was as a result of the uncontrolled descent of the Cosmos 954 satellite, which is a uranium-powered satellite. So it was a nuclear-powered satellite, and there was then a cleanup. Now, no human was injured in this. It was just a cleanup. And the claim was brought by Canada against the USSR regarding the cleanup aspects and the cost to them. And obviously, what happened there was they invoked the Liability Convention on General Principles of International Law. Do we have a case on it? No, because it was settled.
Okay, but we're getting towards that body of law.
And then on other disputes, well, like how do you resolve them? We've got the Liability Convention. And if you have signed up to that convention in 1972, that has a method and a methodology for resolving disputes that arise from damage caused by space objects. So that term.
So where's the forum, though? Where's the court?
Well,
because if it's not attached to a country.
This is international law, and it's between states, so you start with diplomacy.
Okay.
And even in the Liability Convention, you're starting with diplomacy, so you present your claim through your diplomatic channels, and if you don't have a diplomatic channel with that between the two states, you can request another state that has diplomatic relations with both, or you could also use the Secretary General of the United Nations, provided both of you are members of the UN. And if that doesn't work to effect a settlement, which has actually worked on the one precedent we have, you can establish a claims commission. So there's provision for that to be set up with three members and for them to decide and to decide the merits of the claim and determine any compensation payable. There have also been disputes that have been resolved by courts at a domestic level. So,
that option is there.
Yeah, I mean, you're not suing a state, but you can be suing another body. So, and there is an example. There are examples of that.
Okay, this is amazing. This is amazing, Zeldine.
Can we have one of those examples?
Okay, I think the one I really enjoy as a precedent is a case called Nimitz and NASA.
Okay.
Mr. Nimitz claimed he owned an asteroid called 433 Eros. And you might recognize that if you're familiar with the Near Shoemaker space object that NASA launched, because they decided to land it on an asteroid called 433 Eros. And he said he owned that. And then he said, I'm going to bill you for parking fees. In the sum of $20. And he sent them an invoice. It wasn't discharged. So he went ahead and sued them. He represented himself. You can see his filings online. And he argued that he had a property right and that his registration with the Archimedes Institute website conferred a property right, and that he invoked Article 9 of the Californian Commercial Code. ultimately, the claim was dismissed by McKibben, Justice McKibben, because they said he hadn't sought any declarations that he actually owned it, and the US Constitution was not found to provide a cognizable cause of action for the denial of property rights in space. And if you think about it, the US has signed up to the Outer Space Treaty. So anything in outer space is obviously not something that you could claim fell within the territorial jurisdiction that a court could adjudicate on.
Okay.
Now, the question is, what would happen if you removed ex situ the resource and then brought it within the territory of within the territorial jurisdiction to which the court has jurisdiction? And there was another case called INRI 1 Lucite Ball, which was about a... It goes back to the lunar landing missions when lunar regolith was taken from the surface of the moon and brought back to Earth. And some of this regolith was put into a lucite ball with a flag that had been flown on the mission and was mounted on a plaque. And they were given as gifts to various nations of the world as a gift from the US nation. And this particular plaque had been gifted to the Honduran people. And you knew that because the plaque said it. And that had been imported or purportedly imported by someone who purported to buy it, who was a US citizen. And it had been on a wall and then gone missing. I'm using this politely, in the course of a coup in Honduras, and had ended up. And there was a question about whether there could be a property right vesting in that. So that is something that is being discussed at an international level, about this issue of property rights for resources that have been mined or ex situ.
So that they have been identified. So are we saying that there's some fellow with a telescope looking up into the sky and he sees a boulder flying across and he says, that asteroid is mine, I'm the first to spot it?
No, I think we're talking about when the property is extracted and brought within something that a court could have jurisdiction over.
Okay. Can I ask you about people who go into space? I mean, we have the International Space Station.
Yeah.
We have, we have the legendary Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin and Michael Collins stuck up in that, you know, tin can all the way up in space. I mean, what happens if there is a dispute between people, and does the law of the land apply within the context of a rocket or a space craft or whatever? I'm afraid I don't have the proper terminology, but do you know what I mean? Or is it the law of outer space when you've gone beyond?
So actually, the answer is how do you apply what the jurisdiction is? And the jurisdiction in outer space is governed by the state of registry. Yeah. So it's similar to the idea of a flag state. If you're you're in an aircraft or you're on a state, you have a particular state that you can claim jurisdiction on the aircraft. And then if you have a boat on the high seas while you're in an area on the high seas to which there is no state jurisdiction, there is jurisdiction outside of the idea of what's happening in your territory. And in space law, we use the state of registry. So if, for instance, you had two people and they got into a fight, and I think unlikely, but in the idea that there was a criminal act or an alleged criminal act that took place, what law would apply? Well, it would depend where on the ISS the action took place. So if it happened in the Kibo module, that element is registered.
What's a Kibo module?
The Kibo module is the module of the ISS that is registered to Japan.
Is this how the ISS works? There are actually different jurisdictional parts of it.
Okay. Well, there are different states of registry for different parts. So one of the launching states is going to register the space object. We use the term space object because we only see spacecraft used in the rescue and return agreement. The rest of the time, the vocabulary is space object. You put that, the launching state is then the state of registry, and that has jurisdiction. So the jurisdiction would be that of Japan. If it took place on the US element, then it would be the US criminal laws. And all of that actually flows from something that was agreed in the Intergovernmental Agreement of 1998. So it flows from Article 5.
So if a Japanese cosmonaut has a slip and fall in the American part, then he would have it, he or she would have a claim in the American courts for.
I'm not sure how he would fall in microgravity, but I
bumps his head as
there
he...
might be some questions raised sure. on the credibility of okay. that.
Fair enough.
Maybe he might steal the other astronaut's wallet or something, you know what I mean? So there could be a criminal investigation
I
as a result.
Of more interest is what happens if you make a patentable discovery. I think there is, outside
yes.
of criminal law
so that's
jurisdiction,
when it gets interesting
there's
when there's
civil,
a few bob involved. Yeah, course,
when
yeah.
there's a civil law jurisdiction.
Yes.
And so certain yeah, yeah. member states, for instance, of the European Space Agency have legislated for how you deal in their national law. So
has there been a patented discovery?
I can't say offhand.
Okay.
But
okay.
The potential for it in law has been, there in terms of, the it just refers to jurisdiction. So whether it's civil or criminal law jurisdiction, there is a way of ascertaining that and applying a law to there.
Okay. Very interesting.
Now, if one of our listeners or some of our listeners are thinking, this is fascinating, I would like to become a lawyer, an outer space lawyer, where do they go?
I would recommend starting with Isabella Diedrichs for Sure's book. It's an introduction to space law.
Isabella
Diedrichs for Sure's book.
For Sure. How do you spell it? For sure?
It's double barrel DIEDERIKS dash VERSCHOOR.
Okay.
OORS. Her book, An Introduction to Space Law. I'd also recommend you have a look at the United Nations Office of Outer Space Affairs. USA, and look under space law because you will find all of the resolutions, the treaty status pages and the text of the treaties there. And if you want to study space law, I mean, I did it independently. It is possible to study it at a master's level. There are institutes of air and space law around the world. There's one in Cologne, right. Institute for Luft- und Weltraumrecht. There's various ones where you can study at a more advanced level space law, and that'd be something to look into.
And in practical terms, has your expertise in this area ever actually earned you a dime as a barrister? Is there any is there any work in the Irish courts?
I've lectured in the area.
Oh, fair enough.
And, but I would say in practice, there's only a limited number of advisory matters.
But
that have come to my
attention. It must be very dull for you, Zeldin, because you're like yourself. You're practicing at the bar, so you know when you're dealing with a kind of a right of way or. You know, somebody kind of building a wall where they shouldn't. I mean, it must be very dull compared to what's happening up there above the clouds.
Well, if you look at some of the jurisprudence that has come out of courts that do deal with like space law applications, things about fights about satellites, it might sound exotic that it's a fight about a satellite, but ultimately it's insurance law and it's contracts. Yeah. So there's the exotic aspect of what it is, and then there's what the area of law you're actually doing at a domestic
sure.
level.
Okay. Well, this has been great, Mark. Mm. I tell you, maybe this is the new frontier for us all, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah.
Absolutely.
For the Fifth Court. Yeah.
Absolutely.
In terms of new frontiers, I would just like to make one quick reference that Ireland did launch through AirSat 1, so we do sure. have one isn't space object.
Yeah. Well,
it's been
Ireland.
Hailed
well
as our first
Ireland.
Satellite, and it was from students of UCD.
So we do have skin in the game.
For the first time.
Yeah. And a final question,
yeah,
George, put it.
So you're going to have to give us a book. I'm sure there's a book on space law that you want to recommend, but you can recommend any sort of book.
Well, I did say The Introduction sure. to Space Law, and there's another book from Bin Cheng that I think that from 1997.
Okay, let's talk about movies. I'm getting very excited now, you know, and you're not allowed to mention Star Wars, okay?
Okay, no, that I would say Gravity.
Gravity.
Directed by Alphonse Cuarón. It's from 2013. I think it's actually a fairly accurate depiction of what would happen if you had a catastrophic series of collisions of satellites and creating a space debris cloud that then creates an ever-escalating probability of a catastrophe that does manifest.
Okay.
Sounds... Tell us more about Gravity. I'm fascinated.
So
what's the story? It's
the idea of some astronauts who go up on a maintenance mission to upgrade, and there's a collision between two satellites, I think, and it results in a cloud of debris that then comes towards them periodically, and it basically destroys everything in its path. So it's trying to get...
We're not talking a courtroom drama here, are we?
What is very interesting is it presents the idea of space debris the risks that it poses in a very clear way.
Okay.
That it's the risk posed to usable, the functionality of space for everyone, and also as well as then putting a human element of the risk to the actual people up there.
Brilliant. Zeldine, thank you very much for joining us here
in
the Fifth Court.
Thank you for having me.
The Fifth Court will adjourn until next week.
So that's all from this edition of The Fifth Court. We hope you have enjoyed it. Can we say a huge thank you to our guest, Barrister Zeldine O'Brien, for that absolutely riveting, fascinating discussion on the law of outer space, Mark.
Yeah, there was no discussion of litigation against aliens, but we'll bring it back.
Okay, so the next time you go up in a rocket, you know, remember somebody's watching you. That's all I can say to you. But really good, in fairness, that was really, really interesting. You know, that was kind of something new, wasn't it?
Absolutely,
I mean, you know, a lot
of
the stuff we talk about, people have a handle on it. This was brand new, I thought. It was really good. Okay, before we go, I would also like to say a huge thank you to our producer, Cunnel O'Moroyne, and to Lee Brennan of the Dublin South Podcast Studios for the superb work in recording this show. Lee, doing a brilliant job as always. So from me, Peter Leonard.
Myself, Mark Tottenham.
Thank you for listening, and we'll see you soon in the Fifth Court.
Never miss a vital Irish legal judgment. Check out Decisis Law Reports, where you'll find a fully indexed collection of all Irish judgments delivered since 2011. Visit decisis.ie to find out more.